This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, screenwriter Zach Sklar joins us to talk about the recent film Trumbo, about the Hollywood 10.
Zach Sklar says it's all about fear.
We'll speak with attorney Eleanor Stein, who discusses the recent agreement that came out of the Paris Climate Change Conference.
Last week, the headline on Echo Watch read, "Fossil fuel stocks tumble, renewable energy stocks soar."
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, you grew up in Senator McCarthy's home state of Wisconsin. Do you have some stories about him?
Well, you know, I grew up in a little village north of Milwaukee called Fox Point. The good senator lived in Appleton, Wisconsin, about 70 miles northwest of me. I say the good senator because President Eisenhower said, anybody who's an ex-Marine and a chicken farmer can't be all bad. But he was. Yeah. There was an atmosphere of fear and hysteria, I remember from high school. I was a subscriber to the Realist magazine that Paul Krasner put out. And, you know, I wasn't that political, but I was like, I was radical. You know, I knew something was wrong. In that sense, you know, I was radical. The Realist magazine offered a poster, which I sent away for and put up in my bedroom. It was a red, white, and blue poster, and it said, F you, you know, the rest of it, communism. And I had that hanging in my bedroom. And then I wasn't a very good high school student, but I did like history. The history teacher liked me and invited me to come over. He lived in a one-room in a boarding house in our community, and he invited me and my friend Sue to come over to visit him. So we did, and he invited us up to his bedroom, and we sat on the bed, and my history teacher said, I've got something I want to show you. And he reached down underneath the bed, and he pulled out a Pete Seeger album.
Oh.
And he said, I'll play this for you, but don't tell anybody that I showed it to you. Pete Seeger had just been put on the blacklist. You know, they had the number one hit song in the country.
What was that?
Good Night Irene.
Oh, right.
Lead Belly's song. Yep. And then they were blacklisted after that. Seeger was called before HUAC, and he took the First Amendment, freedom of belief and freedom of association. And he said to him, I'll tell you anything you want to know about me, but I'm not going to tell you my religion or my politics. He said, and I'd be happy to sing you a song. And he just made them crazy, frustrated them, because he kept telling them he wanted to sing them a song. And he stood on the First Amendment, and luckily didn't go to prison. Mm. Others did. But in any case, this is 1957 when I was introduced to Pete Seeger. I was 15 years old. And then 1960, by the time I was 18, I went to college. The only college I could get into was the University of Wisconsin, because they'd take anybody as long as you grew up in Wisconsin and were vouched for by your principal as being a person of good moral character. I unfortunately had a principal who did not believe that I was a person of good moral character. And
why was that, Michael?
Well, I was like a juvenile delinquent.
Uh-huh.
And I also was an overt cigarette smoker.
Really?
They had a place in my high school called Cancer Corner, which was a barrel on the corner of the football field in full view of the entire school, which had big plate glass windows. And I would stand out there and smoke, so I was like labeled a bad guy. And the principal did not like me and would not sign off on my going to college. But the guidance counselor, who was an ex-Marine like my father, did like me. And college started in September. In August, he forged the principal's name on my application, and I got into college just under the wire. So I started college. And I joined a fraternity, and the fraternity had an ex-president who was then in graduate school. I went to graduate school in history, a guy named Ralph Levitt, and he went to the University of Indiana as a graduate in history. And there, he and two other people were indicted for conspiracy to overthrow the government of the state of Indiana, why anybody would want to do that, I don't know.
But what had they done?
Well, here's what they did. They were talking about socialism in Ralph's living room. And two members of the Young Americans for Freedom, which was this very right-wing youth group who were big Goldwater supporters. They climbed up on the roof of Ralph's building, and they lowered a microphone down the chimney. Oh. And they recorded his talking with these two other guys about socialism.
And, Michael, that's so COINTELPRO.
No kidding. And they got him indicted for conspiracy, which is you don't have to prove an act. It's just a thought crime.
Right.
To overthrow the government of Indiana. So, and Ralph and his two friends were in the Young Socialist Alliance, which was the youth group affiliated with the Socialist Workers Party. So the Socialist Workers Party came to their defense, and they hired the great constitutional lawyer of his time, Leonard Boudin.
Oh, yes.
And Leonard,
Kathy's father.
Kathy's father. And Leonard represented them, and they beat the rap.
That's amazing.
So this is in 1960. But I remember Ralph came to back to the fraternity and gave a talk about what they were trying to do to him. And then he passed around a petition for people to sign in his support. And I knew that if I signed this petition, I was going to be on a list.
Right.
And, I signed it anyway.
Right on.
And I got on a list.
And that's the beginning of your radicalization.
Well, yes, it was. And then later on, I got involved in the anti-war movement, and by 1967 I had finished law school, and I was very active in the anti-war movement, and to the extent that I was really on the side of the Vietnamese. I thought it was a colonial war of liberation. The United States was on the wrong side, and I sure didn't want to go over to Vietnam and shoot Vietnamese.
And you were of draft age then.
Yeah. So
of course.
Here's how I got out of the draft. I thought, well, they must have they had an outfit called VISTA, Volunteers in Service of America. It was like the domestic Peace Corps. So I wrote them and I said, "Do you have a program for lawyers? Because I'd like to join." And they wrote back and they said, "No, but so many people have written us asking us about having a program for lawyers. We decided to set one up, and you're welcome to apply." So I applied, and I got accepted. And I remember the program was organized by a friend of Kennedy's. And we trained in Chicago. But I didn't want to stay in Chicago. You could either stay there or go to Detroit, one of those two places. And I knew Chicago, it was hopeless. Mayor Daley was the mayor of Chicago. Lenny Bruce used to say...
Wait, still Mayor Daley?
His father,
right.
He was the mayor of Chicago, but that was really an honorific position. He was really the head of the Chicago Democratic Party, which ran everything there. City was utterly corrupt. You couldn't accomplish anything politically. I remember I had a friend whose parents owned a factory that manufactured floor mats. Guy in my fraternity was from Cleveland. I used to drive through Chicago from Cleveland to get to Madison, where I was in school. And one day he got stopped by the Chicago police. And most of my friends who drove through Chicago would put a $10 bill in their wallet next to their license plate. So when they got stopped by the cops, they'd show them their license plate in the wallet. The cop would take the 10 bucks and let them go. But my friend Harley didn't have a $10 bill. So he actually got out from under getting a ticket by giving the cops his floor mats. So I didn't want to go to Chicago. So I went by default to Detroit. Little did I know that Detroit was this marvelous political place, really one of the headquarters of the anti-war movement, along with New York. And of course, Malcolm X had been from Detroit. Malcolm's nickname was Detroit Red. And the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, a group of black syndicalists, auto workers formed in Detroit. The anti-war movement there was very strong. I got involved in it, and then I set up with six friends of mine a National Lawyers Guild movement law firm in Detroit. We bought an old building.
Jim Lafferty, Ron Riosti, Abdin Jabara.
Yeah, we were.
Victor Pipikian.
Dick Sobel. They were all executive directors or presidents, vice presidents of the Lawyers Guild. And we bought an old building and we fixed it up into offices and we represented the movement.
I bet you were spied on by the FBI.
Well, all the time. And we couldn't figure it out. We bought a machine that put out sonic waves inside of the living room. So if you open
your own LRAD device.
It was, exactly.
Yeah.
And if you open the door, it would set off this alarm, you know. And so when we went home at night, we would put the machine on, And every so often, the machine would go off, and we couldn't figure out why. And I thought, well, you know, it must be a mouse. And then Dick Sobel sued and got our papers. And it turns out that the cops were breaking into the building and going through our files. A lot of our clients were draft resistors or anti-war GIs, and the cops were going through our files. So when I stopped practicing in Detroit and moved to New York and started practicing here, and I was a member of the Socialist Workers Party, and I was active in the anti-war movement and active in publishing radical books. And we decided that we should sue the FBI and the CIA and all the rest of them and get a declaration from a federal court that it was legal to be a socialist. So we hired Leonard Boudin, and we sued in federal court. Judge Thomas Griset, who's still on the bench.
Amazing.
He was the judge back in 1982. And we won.
Amazing.
And we won $250,000. We showed all this disruptive activity that the FBI in their program COINTELPRO was doing to us, getting people fired from jobs, burning down people's apartments, breaking into our headquarters, sending spies into our organization. We laid it all out, and we won. We won $250,000, and we won an injunction.
That's amazing, that Michael. I don't think you would have won now.
No, I don't think so either.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. And the injunction said?
The injunction said that it was legal to be a socialist and that the police, secret political police here, like the FBI, had no business spying on us or disrupting us. And the National Lawyers Guild also, I don't think they were able to bring it to conclusion, but the Lawyers Guild was also subject to COINTELPRO.
Well, the Lawyers Guild did sue the FBI, and there was a settlement in which the FBI admitted that they had monitored them for 4 decades, Michael, and infiltrated their offices and meetings.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been going on for a long time, folks, and the only answer is keep exposing them. Shine some sunlight on him and fight back, just like Trumbo did.
In the late 1930s and early 40s, many artists, writers, and intellectuals who sympathize with the poor, the labor movement, and the fights against racism and fascism align themselves with the Communist Party. It followed the Stalinist policy of the Popular Front. When the government's anti-communist witch hunt got underway soon after the end of the Second World War in 1946, many in Hollywood were placed under suspicion. Lists of names were drawn up, and those named were subpoenaed by the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC. Novelist and screenwriter Dalton Trumbo had joined the Communist Party in 1943, and he was on that list. In 1947, when called to testify before HUAC, Trumbo refused to do so on the basis of freedom of association and freedom of thought, both supposedly guaranteed by the First Amendment to the Constitution in the Bill of Rights. Trumbo subsequently spent 11 months in federal prison in Kentucky. He was blacklisted and couldn't get a job in Hollywood for 13 years, but nonetheless won Oscars for 2 movies he wrote under other names. The new movie Trumbo, starring Bryan Cranston, has just been released in theaters across the country. The movie does an effective job of showing the fear of communism that was generated in those dark times and how it decimated Hollywood and was used for thought control. We speak with Oscar-nominated screenwriter Zachary Sklar, whose father was also a screenwriter and a friend of Trumbo. Zach's father was blacklisted and never worked in Hollywood again. Zach grew up in Los Angeles during those days. Zach Sklar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Zach, you recently saw the new film Trumbo. Tell us your reactions.
Well, Trumbo is a film about a screenwriter, Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the Hollywood Ten. They were blacklisted in 1947, just when the Cold War was heating up, so to speak. They were cited for contempt of Congress because the House Un-American Activities Committee had gone to Hollywood seeking headlines because celebrities always bring headlines, and they were accusing the Communist Party of influencing movies with subtle messages, supposedly. And their way of getting those headlines was to call writers, screenwriters, and directors and actors in front of the committee and to ask them a simple question: are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And then subsequent to that, they would ask, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Screenwriters Guild or the Screen Actors Guild or any other union? The Hollywood 10 refused to answer those questions because they stood on the First Amendment and with freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, took the position that it was none of the government's business what party they belonged to. It was perfectly legal to be a member of the Communist Party or any other party. And it was perfectly legal to be a member of the Screenwriters Guild or any other union, but it was none of the government's business. And so they refused to answer the questions, and they were indicted and tried and sent to prison. Well, not tried. They were cited for contempt, and the House voted for them to be sent to prison, which they spent a year in prison. So Trumbo, this is the story of Trumbo, and he was one of them, one of the most outspoken. He was one of the most famous screenwriters in Hollywood. And later he wrote Exodus and he wrote Spartacus. Those were the two films that eventually broke the blacklist. When he was given credit on those two films in 1960, that was the end of the blacklist. The beginning, though, what happened was that they were not just cited for contempt and had to go to prison, but immediately the motion picture producers, the heads of the studios, issued a statement saying that they would not hire any people who were communists or suspected of being communists. And that was led by the dear, affable, mustachioed Walt Disney. And with the blessings of Screen Actors Guild President Ronald Reagan at the time.
And John Wayne. Don't forget John Wayne.
Yeah. So what this meant was that if you were named, or if you were called and refused to answer questions, or if you took, even if you took the Fifth Amendment and said that you did not, you know, against self-incrimination, you would not go to jail, but you would not be allowed to work in the industry. So the studios took the easy way out and yielded to the public pressure from Congress and from a lot of right-wing groups like the American Legion, Veterans of Foreign Wars, right-wing columnists like Hedda Hopper and Walter Winchell, who sort of all got into this hysterical frenzy that was really what, you know, became known as the McCarthy era, really was more aptly named the J. Edgar Hoover era, because a lot of this was fed by Hoover's files on and his obsession with communism, which he considered a threat to the United States. I, growing up, knew that communism was no threat to the United States because I knew these people. They were hardly dangerous, and they, in fact, had led a lot of the best struggles for civil rights, for unions, for, women's rights, all these issues. They were out on the front lines, and I think that was the threat that they were really worried about.
You had a personal connection to the...
Yes, my father, George Sklar, was a blacklist. He was blacklisted. He was a screenwriter and a playwright and a novelist. But once he was named, and you have to understand, once he was named, he could not work in the industry. And you have to understand that being named in one front of one of these committees, it did not have the usual judicial rights that you would have in a courtroom, where you would be able to confront the accuser, cross-examine the accuser. That did not exist in a congressional committee. You had no right to confront your accuser. You had no right to cross-examine him. A lot of hearsay and third-party opinions and people would cite, you know, something they heard from somebody else about somebody being attending a party here and there or wherever for a front group, a supposed communist front group. And a lot of these groups were groups, if you supported the elected government in Spain, for instance, during the Spanish Civil War, that was considered a communist front group. If you supported anti-lynching legislation, a group founded by Paul Robeson and Albert Einstein, that was a group that was considered communist front. So all these supposed fronts were actually just decent organizations, and if you happened to be someone who signed those things, you would be accused of being a communist. On the other hand, what's good about this film, Trumbo, is that it, from the get-go, it says that Trumbo was a communist and that he was not wrongly accused of being a communist, but he was wrongly blacklisted because it was wrong to blacklist people for any political association. And as they pointed out in their testimony before the Congress, you could blacklist people. Next thing they would do is blacklist people because of their religious association. And of course, we're starting to see that now with Muslims. But of course, we saw it long ago in American history during the witch hunt trials in Salem. It's been a theme in American history as one group or another gets singled out as the object of hysteria and the scapegoat. We've seen it with the Japanese internment camps. We've seen it with Irish, Jews, Italians, Chinese. You go through it, through history in America, and you have a history of hysteria one way or another. And of course, more recently, gays, where groups become stigmatized and become the object of this hysteria. At this time, you know, the Trumbo was just one example of what happened with a political association with, communists at the time.
Isn't it true that some of the great films and even television shows were written by people who had been blacklisted but had to use an assumed name?
Yes, during the 50s, of course, a lot of the people who were blacklisted were among the top talents in Hollywood. And you saw during the 1950s and early 60s, there were films that were written by these, and TV shows, written by blacklisted writers, like Lawrence of Arabia, Bridge on the River Kwai, Never on Sunday, Diabolique, you know, Jules Dassin,
right.
High Noon was right. Written by Carl Foreman. The Brave One, which Dalton Trumbo won an Oscar for, but under another name, Robert Rich, and nobody knew who it was at the time. The same with The Defiant Ones, written by Ned Young, another one who was, you know, used as a pseudonym. So, and then, of course, the television shows. There were a lot of writers who moved to Europe and some to Mexico, and they worked in television at very cut-rate prices under pseudonyms or with fronts. So that you had people who were top writers writing Lassie, writing Flipper, writing Robin Hood, Loretta Young television show, all those shows, Leave It to Beaver, all those
Leave
shows
it to
were
Beaver,
being written. Yeah.
A communist plot.
Yeah. Yeah, the friends of my parents wrote Leave It to Beaver. So, you know, and, but, you know, Bobby Lees, who wrote the Abbott and Costello comedies, was writing Lassie. You know, when he wasn't working as a maitre d' in a restaurant to try to support his family because he couldn't make a living on the kind of fees that they were paying for, you know, writers writing under pseudonyms. So my personal connection was that I grew up in this time, and I really felt that the two most important things that were hanging over the whole era were fear and secrecy. Those were the two feelings that pervaded my household. Trumbo is a great movie because it's about a guy who fights back. Trumbo was a real fighter, and he liked to fight about the bank, and he liked to fight the telephone company. He liked to fight the Bluebirds, who were the Girl Scouts that his daughter was thrown out of because he was supposedly a communist. And he wrote letters, angry letters, and he fought all these people. And he triumphed in the end. He was the one that ended up breaking the blacklist. But that was not everybody's experience. My father was very different from Trumbo. He did not fight back. He was broken in some ways by the blacklist. He was fearful. and he suffered, and he in many ways withdrew from the world. He did write novels during that period and had them published, but in many ways his confidence was shaken, and he never quite recovered from that. He never named names, and that was his strength. A lot of people started off by refusing to name names, but in the end sort of collapsed and decided it was too tough and they needed to support their families, and so they did name names in the end. And that's shown in Trumbo with the example of Edward G. Robinson, famous actor who remember from Double Indemnity and many others, Scarface. He was very sympathetic to the Hollywood Ten at first. He was a personal friend of Trumbo's, and for a few years he held out, but in the end he couldn't get work because he was an actor. He couldn't use a pseudonym. His face had to be on the screen, and so he found it too tough. In the end, he named names, and they made him grovel, and they actually made him name Trumbo. He named Trumbo himself, one of his best friends. And this happened often. I mean, during my childhood, one of the weird things, besides the fear and the secrecy you were not allowed to talk to about, you know, your parents' political views, is certainly not about your own, and not to sign anything, not to get your picture taken. All these were rules in my house because my parents were so frightened. But the other thing that would happen is people would disappear. Very close friends of my parents disappeared all of a sudden, and I would get no explanation. Some of them were blacklisted people who decided to move to Europe or to Mexico and eventually came back. But some were informers. They had decided to inform. One of my father's best friends, he worked directing a couple of my father's plays, ended up informing. And all of a sudden, someone who had been dropping by our house all the time, he just disappeared. Never heard from him again. And my parents cut him off. They didn't want to see him again. But this was the kind of thing that was happening. The FBI was coming to the door, knocking on our door. They were monitoring my birthday parties. I later got the Freedom of Information Act files from the FBI on my parents, and most of them were blacked out. Hundreds of pages. What a waste of taxpayers' money, these people surveilling our house, you know. But to see who was at my, you know, they're taking down license plates to see who was at my birthday party. This is the kind of thing the FBI was doing. And it created a climate of fear where you didn't know who you could talk to, who you could trust. Best friends turned on each other. Husband and wife sometimes ended up naming each other. It was a terrible time. You know, it's the kind of thing that when people get afraid, fear is contagious. And we see it now. I mean, it's the same thing now. You can feel it with the terror, you know, the hysteria about terrorism and about targeting Muslims, you know, as supposedly equated to terrorists, just as communists were supposedly equated to spies for Russia. And in fact, what the committee was really angry about and was always trying to undo was all the New Deal that Franklin Roosevelt had brought, and that had been elected four times.
Yeah, and the irony was that the Communist Party during the Popular Front and after was certainly no revolutionary organization. No. People in the party would say that. In fact, they even dissolved themselves in 1943 for a period of time. They were kind of progressive friends of the Soviet Union. They supported the New Deal policies.
Right.
And they also supported rapprochement with the Soviet Union.
Yep.
And the irony was that they tried to make them out as some kind of threat to America, which of course they were not. But I wanted to ask you a more personal question. What about your mother and your brother and sister? What did they do during this time, particularly your mom?
Well, my mother was born in New York, and she was a real tough New Yorker, and her inclination was more like Trumbo's, to fight back, you know. That was the way she dealt with everybody. You know, she was a straight shooter, and she really did not like the way that we were being treated. But she was not the one being named, and she was not the one losing work, so that she's the one who had to support the family. So she was a modern dancer, and she started teaching kids modern dance, and that's what basically supported our family during the blacklist. And my mother was doing everything. I mean, the burden really fell on her very heavily. And in 1953, I think it was, when High Noon came out, there was a screening, and a lot of the left-wing people were there. And I remember my mother came out of that screening weeping, and she felt that she identified so strongly with the Gary Cooper character, who was the sheriff who supposedly is being supported by all the people in the town against these criminals who are coming back. And one by one, all the people in the town desert him, and he feels that he's completely on his own. He has nobody supporting him. And my mother came out of that film and weeping and feeling that she was like Gary Cooper, that basically America had deserted her and all the people like her, you know, that they were isolated and they were being under siege, and it was a very heavy burden for her. My sister and my brother were older than I, and they did know a little bit more of what was going on than I did, but our parents never told us that they were communists. My sister asked, and they told her, "We do not want to tell you because we want you to always be honest. And if someone asks you that question, we want you to be able to tell them without any hesitation that you don't know and be truthful about it." And so they never did tell us. But we had our ways. My sister and brother particularly were older, and they had friends in school who were children of blacklisted people, red diaper babies, children of communists. And somehow these kids found each other, and they talked to each other. And my sister had a little group called themselves the Friendly Conspirators. And they knew what was going on, and that was their experience. Was, you know, I think my brother felt it particularly heavily. I mean, he was a baseball player and in Little League and Pony League, and he wanted to play on an American Legion team. The American Legion was one of the big enemies. They were one of the organizations that was pushing this anti-communist hysteria the most. And so he was put in a big dilemma as to what to do about that. Similarly, I wanted to go when I was a kid to Disneyland, which had opened in the late 50s in Anaheim, California, and everybody else was going, but my parents did not want me to go to Disneyland for good reasons. I mean, Walt Disney had been one of the leaders of the blacklist. So our experience was, you know, it was varied, but the good part of it was that our family really bonded together and circled the wagons, and it was really a feeling of us against the world, and it made our bonds within our family very, very strong. And to this day, my siblings and I are very, very close. And I think that was largely a result of the blacklist, and particularly of my mother's response to it, which was, you know, we're gonna stay together, and We're gonna get through this together.
Well, Zach, very moving. I just want to remind our audience that the bad guys during the witch hunt would not have been happy with young Zach Sklar growing up, because like your father, you grew up to be a screenwriter too. You authored the script to the movie JFK, which pointed clearly to the CIA as assassinating John Kennedy. You've been out there fighting the good fight just like your folks, and we're so happy that you gave us the time to appear on our radio show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Mike. And to your listeners, go see Trumbo. It's not just a lesson in history. It's also quite an entertaining and very clever and funny film.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We'll be right back.
The meeting on controlling climate change by reducing greenhouse gases produced by fossil fuels concluded in Paris last week and involved representatives from 195 nations around the globe. The agreement that came out of Paris is widely believed by climate change activists to be not nearly enough. We need more reductions, or our very existence is threatened. Critics of the talks say it fell short because there were no timetables and no targets and no binding commitments. Joining us today is Albany Law School professor Eleanor Stein, who specializes in climate law. Eleanor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's always wonderful to be here.
You've read the text of the agreement that came out of Paris. Can you outline for our listeners the main provisions?
Sure. I think that, first of all, let me say that the structure of the agreement is that there are two documents. The first is a draft decision of the Conference of the Parties, and it's a decision to adopt the Paris Agreement. And the second piece, which is an annex to the draft decision, is the agreement itself. And this, I believe that this structure is intended in part to accommodate the problems of attempting to get ratification of this document by the United States Senate, and I think this is designed to obviate the necessity to do so. So the decision is kind of a gloss on the agreement itself. But the and it's very important. It has a lot of important information in it. But essentially, the agreement has the meat of it, and it has a preamble which includes a lot of very important concepts and goals that have been lobbied for and argued for and rallied for by the climate movement for the last few years that appear in the preamble but don't really appear in the body of the agreement. For example, a recognition that there are human rights obligations on the part of states to recognize human rights with regard to health and indigenous people, local communities, and so on. The concept of climate justice appears in the preamble for the first time in any one of these UN documents. The concept of just transition of the workforce, which provides the idea that there has to be a plan to transition people who work or are affected by the fossil fuel industry into the new clean energy economy, and a few other things. So there's a lot of good language in the preamble, but it's generally not addressed in the substance, and that's a problem. But at least the language is there. The core of the agreement is Article 2, which lays out the goal of the agreement overall. And the goal is stated as holding the increase in global temperature to below, well, to, quote, well below 2 degrees centigrade. And that's the increase above the pre-industrial temperatures of the globe. Right now, we've just passed 1 degree centigrade. But it also includes language that says the parties will pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees centigrade. And that has been another key demand of the climate movement. So even though it's put in as a pursue efforts language, it's important that it's in the agreement. So that is really the core of the agreement, which is really what is the limit in terms of that's expressed in this agreement in terms of the goal of the world's nations for over the next several decades.
Can you explain to our audience what it means if the temperatures go above 2 degrees centigrade?
Sure. 2 degrees centigrade, I think, was a number that was first floated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the group of the world's scientists that has been called into being by the UN and has published now 5 assessments of where we stand on climate change. And those documents have primarily talked about 2 degrees as you could call it the tipping point or the point of no return, although now that's been really lowered to 1.5 degrees. But I think the key point about that measurement is that that is estimated to be the temperature at which the melting of the Greenland ice sheet becomes irreversible. you know, it will take hundreds of years for it to melt entirely because it's so enormous. But at a certain point, no action that we take can reverse the trend toward melting. And that means we will be looking at, you know, something like fifth of the world's clean water being dumped into the ocean. And that will lead to sea level rises globally of several feet. And the impact of that on our cities and our ecosystems and our food production and river deltas is kind of incalculable. So when all is said and done, that is the main thing we're trying to avoid here.
Is there anything in the agreement that either gives a timetable or is binding on the various countries?
There are several timetables. The essential structure of the agreement is that, unlike Kyoto, which laid out a set of goal, which was a 5% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2012, and the Kyoto Treaty assigned proportionate reduction obligations to all of the countries of the world that were participating in it. So that's become known as a top-down approach. You figure out how much we can afford to emit, and you divide it up. This approach, which has been the one of the UN since Copenhagen in 2009, is a bottom-up approach. So every country put in an estimate of what reductions they anticipated they could achieve by the year 2020, roughly. And the strength of that approach is that countries were presumably making a domestic commitment to achieve those targets. The weakness is fairly obvious, which is when you added them all up, they in fact fall considerably short of what we would need even to stay within the 2-degree mark, to say nothing of 1.5-degree. And that's actually recognized in the agreement what they call the national contributions are insufficiently ambitious to meet the objective.
What can you do about that?
Well, what the agreement purports to do is it has a lot of kind of exhorting language. We should do this, and we would be really good to do this, and countries should make their best efforts to do that. They put in motion what they call a stock take, or a taking stock globally, of where each country is, where all the countries are with their attempts to meet their goals, and to try to ratchet up. They commit to ratcheting up those obligations on every 5-year basis with the attempt to have stopped the increase in emissions by mid-century and begin reduction. You know, taken as a whole, seems to fall pretty far short.
Eleanor, can you talk a bit about the distinction between the obligations and rights of developed versus developing countries? How is that left?
Well, this is, as you know, that's one of the hallmarks of the original treaty, the United Nations Convention on Climate Change, the Framework Convention, and the Kyoto Protocol, which was a clear distinction between developed and developing countries. And the language is the agreements recognize the common but distinguishable or differentiated responsibilities, common but differentiated responsibilities of developed and developed countries. So whereas the old agreement put the onus entirely on the developed countries, the Paris Agreement requires national emission reduction contributions by all countries, regardless of that status, although basically everything else in the Paris Agreement recognizes the difference in circumstances. So, for example, provides that developed countries must contribute to funding to a green climate fund to help the least developed countries and help those that have been the victims of major climate change disasters, although it says developing countries should also contribute. And there's many, many examples like that. Developed country parties should take the lead. Developed countries must have absolute emission reduction targets, so not just we'll reduce 10% less, but we'll reduce our emissions by a certain number of tons of carbon less, which is a much more measurable target. So that distinction remains, but it's for the first time developing countries as well as developed countries have put in their own national contributions to reduction of emissions.
Eleanor, what was the extent of corporate, particularly fossil fuel corporations, what was the extent of their participation in the conference?
Well, there's been some good writing about that, especially coming out of Europe, about how many aspects of the conference were funded by plastic companies and oil companies. And clearly, the fossil fuel companies are watching this and, to the extent they can, participating it with the intention of limiting their losses. Yeah, I think that overall we should see this as a great victory for the global climate movement. And there are many aspects of this agreement which could never have been attained without the tremendous pressure that that movement has put on the world's government. And I think that the fossil fuel industry has been served here. There's clear language that the bulk of the fossil fuel reserves of the world are going to have to be left in the ground, and that a limit is being set on our use of fossil fuel over time. And I think that that will have a profound impact on investment in fossil fuel development compared to investment in renewable energy development, that the handwriting is really on the wall with this agreement.
Eleanor, is this agreement legally binding, and what does that really mean in the international law context?
You're right. Well, it's a really tough question to answer, and it's very hard to tell. And the issue really has always been about the United States. That's the only issue here. You know, everybody in the world is watching the U.S. Senate, let's say, and people in every country in the world are very aware of the political balance of power in the United States as the second largest emitter and the historically largest emitter and still the world's biggest economy. At the very beginning of the decision is referenced the Durban Platform for Enhanced Action, which was a 2011 climate conference attempting to deal with the problem of getting a legal agreement without the necessity of having formal constitutional ratification in the United States. So they came up with this language back in 2011 that said our goal here is to adopt a protocol, another legal instrument, or an agreed outcome with legal force under the framework convention applicable to all parties. And that generally has been read as something that the U.S. can sign. And so I think the attempt here is to do that. So that's one aspect of legally binding. It purports to be legally binding, and it does have a provision for countries to ratify, but apparently that's not required. The problem is that based on its own terms, an awful lot of the language is really precatory. It's really, we're taking this into account, we're recognizing that, we're committing to doing our best to pursue this or that. You know, it's, a lot of the language is very vague. Parties shall take into consideration, and so on. So there's very few places where the agreement actually says parties shall do X. And I think that that's actually going to be the biggest problem in terms of compliance, that you can comply with almost all of this without doing much more than a show of good faith. But in general, and I think this is true in a lot of situations, even with more formal treaties, compliance in international instruments is generally, you know, fairly loose. There is a compliance regime. There are parties. There are institutions at the UN that will assist and provide technical support to parties that are out of compliance. But I think ultimately compliance is going to be the job of the domestic populations of the countries that have signed this agreement, and that the climate movement is basically the compliance mechanism. And it's the mechanism that's going to make countries increase the ambition of their targets, which is really the key thing. There's meetings planned here every 5 years. The first will take place in 2018, but that are going to be stock-taking and then ratcheting up the contributions. And that's where civil society and all of us will find our place in forcing our governments to take stronger positions.
Who are the bad actors in our country?
Well, I think that our biggest problem is is the fossil fuel industry, the oil companies, the gas companies, the coal companies, and, you know, with their leaders, the Koch brothers, Exxon, and then the huge swath of our political representatives who essentially represent those interests pretty much exclusively, and are well represented in both houses of our legislature and in many state houses as well. You know, one of the other blows that they're feeling, besides the language of the Paris Agreement, is the success of the divestment movement, which also was very high profile in Paris, included some actions being taken by the New York State Comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, by Governor Jerry Brown in California, to at least begin to talk about shifting investments away from the fossil fuel industry and toward renewable energy. So that is something that has put them on the defensive, but it's clear that they are going to fight with their last breath, as the tobacco companies have, to hold on to their hold on the energy market.
Eleanor, is there help for the least developed countries and those who are at the most risk for climate change, such as low-lying island nations?
There is, although a lot of it is disappointingly vague. I think that there's a group of least developed countries, or LDC group, that participated jointly in the negotiations, and I think they're probably quite disappointed. There's a lot of language about the developed countries contributing to a green climate fund, which is intended to provide funds to least developed and developing nations for both for mitigation, reducing their emissions, and a lot of it to adaptation, to protecting and safeguarding their populations. And that is supposed to reach the level by 2020 of $100 billion a year, but it's nowhere near that yet. And although the goals are reiterated here, it's not clear how strong that language is going to be. The other aspect that the least developed countries were very interested in here was to have provisions addressing loss and damage, essentially a global indemnification plan, because these are the countries that are receiving the most devastating brunt of climate change impacts and that are least able to deal with them because they lack energy infrastructure, they lack healthcare infrastructure, and so on. So they were hoping for strong loss and damage language in the body of the agreement, and I believe that it is primarily in the preamble. I think there is one article that deals with loss and damage, but again, it's not very strong. So that is going to be a problem for them.
You know, I live a block from the Hudson River. I was thinking of asking you whether I should sell my apartment, but I'm not going to ask you. I'm going to ask you a different question, a question on human rights. And I want to remind our audience, we're speaking with Professor Eleanor Stein, who is an attorney and specializes in climate law. Eleanor, what about the human rights issue? Is there a human right to a livable atmosphere?
You know, that is highly contested territory. Human rights advocates worked very, very hard during the whole length of this conference to try to get literally a human rights guarantee in the body of the agreement. And the words human rights appear in the preamble, but they did not appear in the body of the agreement. However, as I've talked about earlier before on this show, there have been a couple of recent decisions by national courts deciding that their governments had failed in their duty of care to their citizens by failing to take an aggressive approach to climate change. And those decisions were, one was in the Netherlands, the other was in Pakistan, and they were both based on human rights law, at least in part. So some courts have begun to take action on the human rights issue, but it is not strongly supported by this agreement.
Eleanor, we're wrapping up our segment here. Are there any final remarks or observations that you have on what happened in Paris?
Well, I would just reiterate that to me, the most important good thing that happened was the tremendous impact of civil society and the climate change and climate justice movement on the outcome of the agreement and on the theater of Paris. But when you weigh this agreement overall, I think that you will find that it is wanting in ambition in terms of meeting the level of greenhouse gas emission reduction that the scientists assure us we need to do in order to protect our Earth.
Sobering thought. Thank you so much, Eleanor, for, as always, your sage insights.
My pleasure.
Eleanor Stein, really good to have you on Law and Disorder. Be well.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. We'll
bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Nothing.